It's 12 noon on Monday, April 20th, 2026. Welcome to a Q&A extra show where you can ask Jamal or myself anything that you want about anything that you want. And if we're so inclined, we'll answer you. No, we really will answer you, especially if you're a super chat, but not necessarily. We are here normally Monday through Friday, 9 a.m. Eastern time on Rumble and YouTube. But on Mondays and Wednesdays, we also do these supplemental Q&A shows. So if you're new to this, it's just what it sounds like. If you have anything that you want to say to JT or to me or both of us and you want our thoughts or whatever. It can be personal. It can be political. It can be whatever you want to know about whatever. This is your chance, and we look forward to talking to you. And of course, if you have a question for producer Robbie West, who's been known to, who's a pretty interesting fellow himself, feel free to post that in as well. Okay, so away we go. Before we get to it, I just wanted to do a little follow-up to our main topic this morning. The news broke, I'm sure you saw, JT, that the Iranians are, in fact, going to send a delegation to Islamabad.
Interesting. See, for me, what do you think that says? I mean, because to me, again, it's not what I want, right? It's about what we are seeing and the analysis based into what we're seeing. The U.S. has decided that they're going to maintain the blockade. There's that. They're still fighting in Lebanon. There's that.
They seized an Iranian ship.
They seized an Iranian ship. There's that. And now you have Iran going to negotiations with all of that being true. Mm-hmm. Why?
And J.D. Vance apparently will be, again, leading the talks in Islamabad. Why would the Iranians do this? I mean, like, obviously there's a bunch of ways to interpret it. You could interpret it from a point of view of there's more weakness on the Iranian side than you and I think there is, that they're feeling beaten up. They really desperately want to bring this to an end. I don't read it that way, though. I read it in that the way they view this is all wars end with diplomacy. They end with talking, and that if there's no talking, there's no end to the war. You can be winning and want the war to end. And in fact, I think that's where they're at. In fact, you know, you do, like, it's like in gambling. When you're up, that's the time to cash in your chips and walk away. I think the Iranians probably generically feel they don't have the American view that talking is a reward or that diplomacy is a reward. They're probably just like, talking is just talking, and it never hurts to hear what the other side has to say. I really seriously think that's their attitude.
That could be it. How do you think America and Israel view it?
Well, they always interpret any sign of civility, decency, or kindness as weakness. So they're going to view this as, like, we've got the Iranians just where we want them. I really think they're going to tend to view it that way. But I think the question really is, J.D. Vance is leading the delegation. He's going to do this talk. I don't know how much latitude he has. I mean, I don't know if the president said, J.D., go out and do your best. Carte blanche, whatever you do, I trust you, dude. Come back and let me know what you'd come. I don't see him doing that. I think he has to call and check constantly. Hey, the Iranians brought this up. What do you think? And everything has to be signed off. Trump is he's very mercurial. So even though he wants the war to come to a rapid and satisfactory conclusion, or at least not too unsatisfactory, he's also, you know, I mean, he's got to be a hard guy to work for in this context. So, how they interpret it, but basically the bottom line is there's just no denying the fact that the economic pain is now, you know, hitting Asia hard, and it's going to ripple across the Pacific Ocean to the United States, because we're so economically intertwined with the Chinese and all of the Pacific Rim countries and everything. So much of our manufacturing is there. I mean, it's going to hit. And so, you know, even if the U.S. thinks right now, like, we'll be pretty okay. Yeah, you're pretty okay for now. Right. This is kind of like when COVID hit. It hit China first, but, you know, it came around for us. It's going to. Mm-hmm.
I guess the other follow-up question I would ask for that is it in your, let's say, negotiating best interest if this country thinks that what you're doing is a display of weakness? Meaning, regardless of what the Iranians think, they say negotiation is good, talking is good, we're okay with talking, et cetera. But let's be honest, Iran wouldn't have put out the statement that, hey, we may not go to Islamabad if you keep the blockade on, because we consider that to be a breach of trust. And yet you go. This is kind of what I'm hitting at. It's not, look, obviously Iran is doing a stunning job in holding off an empire, right? Mm-hmm. We spend $1 trillion on our military. The fact that Iran could take the strait, we can't take the strait back, is a strategic option that they were able to do, and they were able to do successfully. So heads off. Mm-hmm. By the same token, it doesn't necessarily mean that the murder en masse of the Iranian population and the bombings doesn't hurt, right? Both of those things be true. Mm-hmm. And so for Iran to be dealing with the empire in this way, an empire that thinks, we think negotiation, or let's say coming to negotiation, especially under the context where we're flagrantly violating the ceasefire, we think that's weakness. Yeah. And Iran, on some level, had to think it was weakness too, because otherwise they wouldn't have put out the thing saying, we're not going to show up if you continue to do this. Meaning that Trump is lying. We're not fighting this war on social media. And this blockade goes beyond what we said we were going to basically do. And yet, here they are at the negotiations. Now, you could be right that they have been pragmatic all the way through. They've tried to avoid a war all the way through. And maybe this is just more of that. I guess my thing is, though, I give an example. My aunt has a certain personality that is very difficult to deal with. I love her to death, but she has a very difficult personality. And yet, growing up, my mom was the opposite in this. And so in one kid's case, you get to see, okay, this person is difficult to talk to, will never apologize. And for all intents and purposes, anything that you're dealing with them with, you have to fight tooth and nail for everything because they're going to give you nothing. There's that, right? And so I have to take her point of view into account, because if I know she's not the type that's going to apologize, and I know you have to fight for everything that you get out of it, I have to deal with her accordingly. And whatever I telegraph to her has to be telegraphed knowing that. The opposite is true for my mom. My mom will give you the shirt off her back. I don't need to push all that hard in that case. In fact, I need to do the opposite because I know how she is. Mm-hmm. I'm saying that whatever Iran wants to do in maintaining itself as kind of an even keel in regards to its own priorities, it has to take into account the perspective of the monster that it's dealing with. And so if it's signaling, we're not going to do negotiations because you guys are effectively violating the most basic of terms that we've already gone with, then what does it mean that they're willing to send a delegation when the terms are already being violated? How can you get a deal when the most basic tenets of the ceasefire are not even attended to? And what does it mean for any kind of deal if you're willing to engage in negotiations like that? Now, you can look at it and say, well, they're being pragmatic. I don't know which one it is. I just don't.
So, no, I take your point on everything you just said. And I agree with you. I mean, if I were advising the Iranian government, I would say you might want to think carefully. I'm not 100% sure about this, but there's a strong chance that this will be perceived as weak. I think there's obviously a division within the government, right? I mean, yes. The president obviously is more of an accommodationist. The IRGC is obviously more hardcore.
Rational.
Militant.
Like I'm a rationalist.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's like, yeah. I mean, yeah, I look, God bless the new president, but I don't think he really understands just what colossal assholes the United States are, especially when they're paired with Israel, who's the worst influence ever. Questions? Should we do some?
Yeah, please.
All right,
please.
Let's do it. Okay, deviation. Where do you see humanity in 500 years? Wow.
Either we are going to – look, I think we're in prehistory. I think I've said this before on my channel. I think we're in prehistory. I think when future generations look back on us, we will be looking, they will look back at us in the way that we looked at the Romans or the way they were looked at cavemen, that the things that we did to this planet that we did to each other would be just very difficult to count. Look, there's a great episode of Star Trek Enterprise, The Next Generation. The very first episode of Next Generation, humanity is put on trial by Q. And Picard, who's representing all of humanity, is humiliated, like just deeply humiliated. He doesn't even want to own it, right? And it gets to the point where Q is like, if he says anything other than he's guilty, kill him off. Like it's that, right? Because Picard just doesn't want to own it. It's humiliating. I think that's where we're going to be. I think in the same way we look back and think, I can't believe people did that to each other. We're going to say the same thing about us. Hopefully, or I don't think we're going to exist. It's going to be one or the other. We got to get our shit straight or not.
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, I'm not sure that human beings will be here in substantial numbers or not close to. I think our population is going to fall off a cliff and we'll end up with 5 or 10% of the current population in 500 years due to climate change. The fact is, we're just not doing anything about it at all. And and there's going to be ecocide, massive ecological collapse, civilizational collapse, and it won't be possible for the structure of society to maintain itself. I think we're going to sort of go back to sort of a medieval feudalistic society where there's not even international transport anymore. You know, basically we're living off the land and we're not going to be able to, you know, we're not going to have agribusiness. We're not going to be able to sustain 7 or 8 billion people. Much less 10 or 12. I think it's just going to, by the end of our lives, we're going to see the beginning of the end of humanity as we've seen it so far.
So I guess there's one or two things that, fair point, right? Like if, I guess I always assume we can't see around corners. And in the same way that if people were looking and said, okay, 500 years ago, what do we think the world is going to look like? Mm-hmm. There was no concept of the internet. There was no concept of, cell phones. Like, there was no concept of TV, airplanes. Like, if you think of all of these things that took place over the last 100 years, mm-hmm. it is impossible, right, to see over that horizon to figure out what that looks like in regards to civilization and society. We don't know what space travel looks like. We don't know if there's mm-hmm. some loophole in physics. We don't mm-hmm. know. There's so much that question is kind of impossible to answer. But I accept your take, right? But does it get to a point where things, let me ask you this. After the Second World War, do you think there was a moment for the world to be different?
100%. Yeah, I mean, and it tried in some respects, right? It like the UN was an example of that. The Marshall Plan was an example of that. But Harry Truman ruined everything, you know, by starting the Cold War all by his own little in the Independence, Missouri self. I mean, literally, the Soviet Union and the United States could have carved up the world into spheres of influence and presided over a Pax Soviet Americana. And instead, you know, we know what direction we went, but we had an opportunity. We had a lesser opportunity, but still a big opportunity after the fall of the Soviet Union in 1991. We chose not to, we chose to take a big shit on that opportunity. So, we did have a huge opportunity at the end of World War II. But what were you, why did you ask?
Well, I'm getting at, like, when there are calamities, be it either caused by war, like the Second World War. As you pointed out, the fall of the Soviet Union, I think that was a calamity, believe it or not.
Mm-hmm.
It was a mistake.
I totally agree.
That there are opportunities when things fall apart monstrously. And the thing that you were talking about, the environmental side, or let's say some larger war that just decimates the planet, they may present opportunities. Those are rethinks.
True.
When the world comes again and is like, we royally fucked up. How can we prevent this again?
Yeah, on a nation state level, Germany was saved by being destroyed.
Yeah, exactly.
And if Nazism hadn't been totally crushed and defeated ruthlessly, Germany would not have really had much of a future.
Exactly. Maybe it's that. Maybe ultimately it gets to the point of something that's nearly the brink of disaster for the world, and the world comes together and makes new rules. And I think the one rule that probably needs to be made is no such thing as hegemons, which I don't know how that would get enacted short of the world going to shit and coming up with this kind of new rationale.
Yeah, because the thing is, the nature of hegemons is hegemon's going to have hegemon, right? I mean, it's like a company that finds itself in a position to achieve monopoly status in its sector is going to do that. A millionaire wants to become a multimillionaire wants to become a billionaire.
Exactly. Exactly.
So I don't know how you set up controls against that, right? Because those are also people and entities that have tremendous power. So yes. They're really hard to rein in.
Yeah. But that seems to be what needs to take place. Otherwise, we're back in the situation. I mean, people can say China's a benign hegemon. I don't know if there's such a thing as a benign hegemon.
Not really.
Yeah.
Well, there hasn't been, I would say. Mm-hmm. Manchild, thanks for the dollar. With the high level of division in the U.S., there's been a lot of talk about the possibility of civil war. With no ability to have a Mason-Dixon line this time, what would such a war look like?
That would be a mess.
I don't think we'll have a civil war for the simple reason that we're just not configured that way with state militias. And, we're not like, we may have like internal conflict, but I don't see it falling apart like, Serbia or, like that kind of thing. We don't have those kinds of borders. We have internal divisions, but I kind of question the assumption. Obviously, there's a massive urban-rural divide in this country. Most Western countries have that.
Yeah, I don't see California going to war with Texas in that sense.
No.
But I think when people talk about it, they're thinking of it in terms of this kind of societal breakdown where people end up drawing lines in the context of
parable of the sowers kind of thing. I could see a Soviet, a post-Soviet kind of scenario. 50 states become 50 countries or something. And then some of those countries, come together and merge. You know, Rhode Island and Connecticut and Massachusetts kind of belong together, like that.
That would be a mess. But that's what we're trying to do with Russia, right? Break them up into small constituent little nations that could be played against one another and attacked, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. I mean, I would need to see the scenario break down. I'll tell you this. If Donald Trump came out and was able to succeed in stealing America, I think we would have had a civil war in that case. I think you would have gotten states saying this is a no. Mm-hmm. And in the context of this being a no, we have every right to dissent because you're not the true elected leader of the country. And then at that point, what does Trump do? Does he go to war with California? Does he rally the troops to go against certain states that effectively try to break away, like another civil war? Mm-hmm. That would be a case that I could see, especially with the military saying this is a no, or elements of the military saying no, and other elements saying, yes, we're going to follow the president. That would have been a mess. Mm-hmm. That would have been a complete mess.
True. True, true. Oh, Clovis has stuff to say. Well, come here, cat. Maybe Blue the Funk. Thanks for the $5. Hey, guys, random thought. Do you guys know of like the Cybersyn project in Chile or Norbert Wiener, Bertrand Russell? Many became anti-tech because they foresaw the danger. Love the show.
There's no way out that box, though. Like the ape that beat the hell out of another ape with a bone, like the first tool. Like, I don't know, Space Odyssey 2001. It's like an iconic scene where the ape takes a bone and like beats the shit out of another ape and throws it up into the air and it becomes a spaceship. It's like the greatest segue of all time. People are like, what the fuck did we just watch? What the hell is this? Right? That's a tool. Now you could say, well, we need to stop that ape from getting that bone in order to beat the hell out of the other ape. But it's what we do. It's what human beings, like the very act of needing to eat makes, and the very fact that it causes energy in order to do anything makes you want to find a way to do it better. It just it's just somewhat of a natural norm. It would be very weird to put limits on your capability of doing things better. And mind you, the catch with that though is, well, I can also use this for very horrible things. It's not the technology. It's the, let's say, it's the mind that wants to use it for whatever particular ends. How your society allows that technology to be used is a secondary question, and that has to do with your society. Now, you could say we need to make people dumb so those people would be less inclined to do X or Y. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Is that really what we want to do? Or do we want to, you know, just be better people?
Yeah, no, I
giving a take because
no, like I agree with you 100%. Look, I would love to be able to say like, let's, you know, look, let's ban nuclear weapons. Let's ban capitalism. Let's ban, you know, all sorts of things that are incredibly destructive. You know, but look, human beings can't even succeed. We can't even ban rape or murder. We can't even ban, you know, landmines, even though most of the world is against them. We can't ban cluster bombs, even right. though most of the world is against them. So it's just unrealistic. It's like people who say, get money out of politics. Okay, well, eliminate money or make people not care about money, and then you'll get money out of politics. But otherwise, you will never get money out of politics. All you can do is sort of put on controls. Look, my father used to say this, and I wasn't sure how I felt about it, but I've come to agree with him and therefore with you, Jamal. For sure, technology is neutral, right? I mean, you develop nuclear fission, and yes, you end up with the A-bomb and Hiroshima and Nagasaki, but you also end up and Chernobyl, but you also end up with Chernobyl, but you also end up with nuclear power that now turns out after the no nukes movement to be pretty much one of the cleanest forms of energy that's available, right? And so, I mean, I still have my old no nukes pins from the 1980s, but like the fact is that's, you know, that's obsolete now. We have a different understanding. That understanding may shift again. I think technology is inherently neutral. A knife could be used to stab a person to death. A knife could be used to make dinner. And so, you know, a gun can be used to kill someone. It can be used to save someone. It's just technology. I mean, there's some exceptions. I mean, I think, I don't know if it's really a technology. Like smoking doesn't really benefit anyone. So you could abolish it and nothing bad would happen to anyone. But there's not a lot of stuff like that. And it's not really a technology. I mean, it's just burning leaves. I guess that was a technology at one time.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. I just don't know. This is a human nature thing, right? Like human nature is water in a glass. And technology is kind of the same. It's just an extension of will and want.
Totally.
And yeah, making things easier. It's just how it's used.
Dark like, Horse.
That's why I love the Venus Project. Do you know who Jack Fresco is?
No.
Okay. Jack Fresco had this thing called the Venus Project, which was effectively eliminating work. Making a technological society where technology works to the betterment of humanity. Mm-hmm. And it puts you in mind of a Star Trek-esque point of
view. We live only for pleasure on this planet. The machines do all the work for us
machines
now.
Machines do all the labor. And his thing was like, dude, you get rid of poverty, you get rid of hunger, you feed the population, you ensure the people are good. And in doing so, you eliminate or at the very least cut down on crime because crime is often an extension of difficult circumstances.
Oh, of course.
Yeah. The Venus Project is in Venus, Florida, if I'm not mistaken. He has a little version of it for people to see and walk around and get their sense of it. Yeah, I think it's necessary. It's either that or barbarianism.
I have a question. Dark Works is requesting that I tell the brownie story.
Brownie? You mentioned that earlier today.
All right. Yeah. So here's the story. Okay, so New Year's Eve, it's the early 80s. I have two roommates. We live in a sixth floor walk-up in Spanish Harlem in New York in the 80s. It's exactly as sketchy as you would imagine. So I had a girlfriend who was 18. I was 20. And she had a lot of young high school friends. Long story short, she's like, oh, can I invite some of my friends to this party? It's the 80s. We're like, yeah, sure. Come on over. Drinking age was 18, but whatever. So some 16-year-olds come and drink. We're like, whatever. Long story short, before the party starts, my roommate, Chris, the degenerate, is like making pot brownies. He's like, oh, you got to try this, Ted. I'd never had any drugs ever in my life.
And really? So, you're in the 80s? You're in the 70s?
Well, I drank like a fish, but I didn't. Yeah, I mean, so I was like Cash Patel. I was out of control. But anyway, but the point is that I'm like, okay, so I eat the brownie. Now, there was so much weed in there, granted, not like, you know, 2026 hydroponic awesome right. weed, but like, you know, but I, it good was enough. So much weed in there that it basically was like eating lawn. Okay. So I ate the brownie. And then of course, this is a classic rookie error, right? So I go, so Chris goes, well, he only smoked, right? He didn't really eat brownies.
Yeah.
He edibles weren't really much of a thing in the 80s. He goes, do you feel anything? After like 5 minutes, I'm like, mm-mm. He goes, ah, you better eat another one. So.
Oh, Rick and the State.
So while.
Rick and the State.
Real mistake. So I'm like, I'm at another one. He's like, now do you feel anything? I'm like, no. Nah. He goes, well, obviously they're weak. Long story short, I eat eight of them, right? And each one's like
you
this.
You ate eight brownies?
Eight brownies. They were like this big, right? And, you know, I mean, nothing's really happening. At the whole time, I'm like, well, brownies suck. And obviously, I have incredible resistance to drugs because I'm awesome. So I figured, like, just to keep the evening going, I'm, like, also serving drinks. So I'm serving myself rum and Cokes the entire evening. I'm pretty sure I had eight of each. Eight rum and Cokes. And things start to get fuzzy around 10:30 when I basically go, fade. But my mind blacked out, but my body kept going. Really? So apparently things got really out of hand and I was yelling all sorts of inappropriate shit to people. I don't even know what I was saying. Nobody told me. But apparently it was rude, crude, and socially unacceptable. We had a half-size refrigerator that, you know, not the big ones, but the ones that are like, I don't know, maybe 3 feet tall. I carried that up to the roof and threw it off the roof and it landed on a parked car. Yeah. Yeah. Cause I lived on the top floor. So it's like easy to get to the roof off the top floor onto a parked car. Could have killed someone. Thank God it was freezing cold. No one was out. And I wake up and there's like, I'm in bed with my girlfriend and her sister and we're covered with Worcestershire sauce. And
what? I know what y'all doing.
So I'm like, and then it's like I hear like my roommates knocking on the door, like their parents are here. I'm like, oh fuck. So I'm kind of like the guy in RoboCop, like bitches leave. I'm like, bitch, just go. I'm like, oh my god, it's 5 p.m. I've slept through the entire day, and like I go outside. There's like naked people like passed out unconscious on my floor. There's broken holes. There's holes in the plaster. There's balloons everywhere, broken windows. I mean, it was like, you know, like the B-52 song, a party out of bounds. Yeah. So I had a hangover that lasted 3 days. And I was like, like the Nick Lowe song, I'll never go drinking again. So I swore off drugs after that because it was so bad.
You know, the only thing bad about that is there was no video camera.
Well, that's true. No, we wouldn't have behaved as recklessly if there were cameras. You know, I think everyone's got to be more careful now.
I don't know, man. Like, and that's the other wild part, right? Like, if that was today, that would be online forever.
Oh, and by the way, so the asshole party attendees, I guess I didn't close my bedroom window. They went up to the roof and they were watching me like through my bedroom window the entire time. So I don't remember anything, but I mean, they all saw it. So that would have been filmed. So yeah.
And you swore off drugs after. You were like, all right, I'm done.
I was like, drugs are not for me. Yeah.
See, I've had brownies. I mean, I've tried psychedelics. I'm not a big fan of psychedelics, but I've tried. I don't like to be on rides that I can't get off. It freaks me out.
What
is the roller coaster?
Well, that's what it felt like too. It really felt like a roller coaster, like physically, you know.
Well, I don't know if people haven't tried edibles. One thing that you would learn is that when you want the high to go away, it doesn't go away. It just stays.
Right.
And it could be 4 hours.
You're just along for the ride.
Yeah, you're just along for the ride. You just have to talk yourself down. I haven't had a ride that bad. I mean, I've had humiliating moments, like where my ex used to do brownies. She would make them. And they were good brownies. Not like you're eating chalk, but like when she made cookies and stuff like that, it actually tasted like cookies. And if you didn't know any better, you were in for a hurting. You're going to get hurt.
Oh, my God.
I remember having cookies once and going to a doctor's visit. And my ex-wife sent me a text message as I was on the way. Hey, these things are very strong. Now, she does not have a tolerance for it, right? She had like crumbs. Like she was like eating the batter, the taste of it. She was wasted.
Oh, shit.
And she calls me like,
warning, warning.
Yeah, just give me warning, right? As I'm three cookies in, I get to the doctor's office and I start feeling myself go high. And I was like, all right, let me hit my
Here we go.
I need my escape hatch, which is my food, right? It's like, okay, you eat to try to bring yourself down. I eat what I had. It doesn't do anything. I'm about 30 minutes in and I am stoned off my ass, which means I know I'm screwed because I know there's still another 30 minutes of going up to go. I get to the doctor's office. I throw up on myself. There's that. The high doesn't go anywhere. Doesn't go down. And I get to the point where I even have to tell a nurse, humiliatingly, I've had cookies. I'm stoned off my ass right now. Yeah, it was not a good experience. I was humiliating experience. But nothing like that. I mean, I've had times where I couldn't function because of it. But that's usually when I don't know what's going on in regards to the dosage. But I'm not a quitter.
Well, I will say, I did swear off drugs from that moment. However, there's a few I had a couple of subsequent experiences. And by the way, thank you, Arian Gordy on YouTube for the $4.99 donation. Good morning, fellas. Craziest, this is all relevant to your question. We're answering it right now. Great, craziest 420 story. Not sure if this was asked. Happy 420 to everyone. Stay high. All right. So,
It is 420. That's right.
It is 420. So it's so appropriate.
We should have been taking bong hits and all, man.
Years later with my ex-wife, she wanted to do a do-over. She knew all about this experience. She knew the two other reprobates involved. And she wasn't at that party because we weren't going out at the time. But anyway, the point is, she was like, oh, let's do brownies. I'm like, okay, but I'm only going to have like one or two because I'm not like, I fucked up and I didn't drink as much. Anyway, I ended up, do you ever see The Serpent and the Rainbow? Great movie. Yeah. It's about voodoo, Haitian voodoo. And basically there's this scene where a guy basically he like his breath slows to the point where everyone thinks he's dead and they put him in a coffin, but he's still alive. And like a spider is like walking on his face. Anyway, he can't move. That's what happened to me. I couldn't move. I'm like literally like paralyzed in place. And my sadistic ex-wife was like tickling me like crazy. And I couldn't like move to make her stop or get away from her or anything. And I was, and I was like, I'm trapped in my own body. It's like being in a coma. And like, it was so that was horrible. Then in 2010, I was on my way back from Afghanistan with a friend.
Yeah.
We were in Amsterdam, and you know what you do in Amsterdam.
Oh, yeah.
So we ended up at the coffee shop, and we had 2 days in a row. He had more than I did, but I had a little space cake, little €3 space cake. Hash. I got to say, that was really pleasant. Just sat in the window and had a beer and watched the world go by. And it was very calm. But I remember telling Matt, this is not for me. I would not do anything. I would just get up in the morning and just do this. And I would never work. I'd never write. I'd never draw. I don't think this would be good for me. But it was totally enjoyable. And it's interesting to me. I don't know why. You can't really get hash in the U.S. Like, dispose, don't have hash. Like, it's not an American thing. I don't know why. Hash is great.
It's abroad, like in Egypt and in the Middle East and places like that. You can get your hands on it.
It's the stems, right, basically?
I don't like alcohol, right? If we were out, I'd drink. And I met people, like, when I was traveling where, they would find out where I am. Let's say, like, it was a guy in Germany. He was like, hey, man, let's go to the bar. We sit there and drink and smoke all night. But under normal circumstances, left my own devices. Not really so. But if we went out, if I went to New York, we totally go out. I get hammered with you, right? Pot, I do like. I like the high. And it doesn't, inhibit me from doing stuff. In fact, I always say it puts me in contact with my heart center. Like how I become softer in dealing with people and in my thinking of people. Like I feel more
deeply. See, that's how I am with drinking. I think obviously we have different body chemistries. And yeah. I've known a lot of people like you who like, they don't understand. They're like, Ted, you're a natural for weed. Like,
yeah, totally... I would have thought you were, if not a stoner, had plenty of, you know, knockdown.
My physiology doesn't agree. I had my very first book signing was in New York for 1992 for my first book, Waking Up in America. And it went swimmingly well. And at the end of the event, we were in there, they served drinks, so everyone's lubricated. At the end, the staff said, we are going to extend we're going to extend an invitation that we've only ever extended to Kurt Vonnegut. And I'm like, whoa, what's that? And it's like, come down to the basement and smoke weed with us. And I had to say no. I was like, well, I can drink wine. You're like, what? No, it's got to be weed. No? And I was but you don't understand. I'm like allergic to weed.
I know, yeah. But I'm not a big fan of alcohol either, right? But I tell you, I have two experiences. When I was abroad, I was looking.
If there was hash, I would have done.
You would have taken it though for the
hash. I liked the hash. Yeah, the hash was good.
The hash was good. Trump,
executive order bringing hash to the United States. Got to do it.
Got to do it. You should do it. I don't see why they don't have it, considering it's legal in so many states.
Plus, they're probably throwing away the parts that are used for hash, aren't they, in the production process? Because I thought. Correct me if I'm wrong. I thought that was the stems of the cannabis plant. Or is it a
different people do use it, like they make extracts. Sometimes mm-hmm. they use it for like cuttings and stuff like that. Like if you're making stuff like brownies and those type of things.
I love topicals, by the way. I don't know if it's it's just power of suggestion or whatever, but I feel like it helps.
Some of them work. I mean, some of the stuff does have medical benefits.
They have to be like strong, prostate, though.
Pain. I was in Czech Republic. My ex-wife and I, we were... So I had a clinic that was in Poland, but the clinic was in a Polish border. So I would have to go from Czech Republic to Poland and just drive across the border. I was looking for a chess club. And there was this little bar that had a chess pieces on the window. And I was like, obviously they have chess there. I mean, why would they have it on the thing? I walk in, it's about 1 p.m. And when they realize, American, I can hear somebody say, American! Shots, right? And they start pouring vodka shots back to back to back to back. I was 5 shots in when I finally was like, I have to go. I can't.
That's a lot of shots.
That's a lot of shots.
Yeah.
I am.
And you weren't even in Russia.
I wasn't even in Russia. But, you know, you're like right close to it. Like, you know.
Oh, yeah. You might as well be in it. Yeah.
I am sober enough to get home, throw up, and pass up.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I have a hard time throwing up. That's part of my problem too. So if things get out of control, I'm stuck with it.
That too. When I was in, so my ex-wife and I also were in Spain, and we were Spain has marijuana laws, kind of like DC did. Like you can't really sell it, but you can own it. And so you can buy like a pencil, and I'll gift you $40, mm-hmm. Gift you the pot, but you got to give me $40 for a pencil. It's kind of like that. Uh-huh. My ex-wife and I go in, we smoke. It's like a restaurant where people come in and do work. Sometimes they're doing stuff, but you can go to the marijuana bar, get whatever you want from a standpoint to smoke, and get whatever smoking device that you want, and just sit there, watch TV, do work, listen to music. I think Marvin Gaye was playing at the time. My wife and I sit there and get wasted. I've never been that stoned in my life. And we're so stoned that we're watching this movie with no sound of a cartoon character who goes out into the water, dips his pen in, comes back, puts it on his canvas, it fills with it. He's dissatisfied with it because it's removed the water from the lake, and he takes the color and puts it back. Her and I are riveted. We think this is the greatest work of art that has ever taken place. And we, when it went over, it's like, where's part two? I need to get to the clinic that day. I am so stoned that the moment that I stand up, my brain is not there. I'm just blank. And she grabs me and drags me to the cab. And I'm in the cab thinking to myself, for one, I'm catatonic. She's talking to me. I can't respond. The cab driver, I'm thinking to myself, he hates us. I'm defiling his country. I'm a degenerate that's in this country getting stoned. I get to the clinic. My ex-wife, she is wasted, but she is competent enough to get us there. Where she goes and lays down somewhere. I don't even know where she goes. I am, at the very least, aware enough to talk to the doctors and the nurses. And at the time, I cannulate myself when I do treatments. And they're like, so, Mr. Thomas, we hear that you cannulate yourself. And I'm like, yeah, I do. Okay, here are the needles. I'm still stoned. I get the needles in. It's not a great job, but I get them in. And for 3 hours, I am sitting there with the world just spinning. I've never been that high in my life. I've never been that stoned in my life. And I don't think my ex-wife has ever been that stoned in her life. Nor do we think that would happen in Spain, of all places. I don't know, man. I don't know. Some of those things are their experiences.
Oh, that for sure. No doubt about that.
They're definitely experiences.
PayUpa, thank you very much for the $2.79 Canadian. Do you guys think Trump might try to win a third election? Yes.
Not now. Whatever plans that were there, that shit is in the ground. I mean, it's one thing if you say, will Trump try to usurp America?
Well, that's what we mean, since it's against the Constitution. Yeah.
Right. But winning an election or trying to... Oh, I see what you mean.
Just staying in power, I think. Yeah. That's the way I read power. The question. Yes, yeah. I would think so. Declaring a state of emergency... trying to have the Constitution amended, some kind of sleazy thing where Vance runs on the top of the ticket and he's the vice president or whatever.
Yeah. See, that's when civil war comes into play for me.
Well, it should if we're a functioning country, ironically.
Yeah. 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 I mean, that's when states to me are like, no, especially blue states.
They're
like,
fuck no.
Yeah.
Now, although I suspect they would let themselves be rolled.
You think so?
Yeah, I mean, where's there been any resistance? They'll schedule one extra No Kings rally per year. I mean, on a Saturday, weather allowing.
So you're thinking of this in the sense of political parties. I'm thinking of this in the sense of the population saying, fuck no.
That's what I'm talking about. There's not going to be any protests. Nothing will happen. Nothing will burn. Nothing will be blown up. Nothing will happen.
Oh, Ted, I think the level of anger would be... astonishing, but I don't know. You could be.
Right. I think it would be just like and by the way, grinding rage. True,
yeah, but if that's true,
people would just bite their tongues. I mean, they'd be pissed. They'd be like, "This sucks," and you know, sure. And SNL would do lots of skits about it. That's about it. Nothing would happen.
I don't know. I'm skeptical of that one for some reason. For some reason, I feel like the rage would be palpable. And this idea of trying to pretend as if America is some kind of democracy and everything else, that shit's off the table. Meaning all credibility is gone.
All credibility would definitely be gone. I mean, it's close to it now. All right, more questions. John Park, what do we think about Turning Point USA's poor attendance at Athens, Georgia? That was the J.D. Vance thing, right? I feel Gen Z Republicans aren't buying this Erica Kirk BS anymore, but could be totally wrong. Love the show, guys. I mean, that could be anomalous, but I kind of agree with the mainstream view that it does seem to be Turning Point just ain't the same without Charlie Kirk. You know, and so, and you can't, I mean, if they could find someone young and vigorous who doesn't have to be a clone of him, of his, but someone who can pick up the mantle, then sure, but it's not Erica Kirk. I mean, Erica Kirk doesn't have it in the same way that Hillary Clinton didn't have the bill thing.
Right.
I hate to say it, she's a skank. And, you know.
Jesus.
She's a skank. Good New Jersey word, right? She's just the merry widow. God knows what she's up to. She decided to cash in on her husband's legacy. Seems like the happiest she's ever been. You know, it's the whole thing is tawdry and gross. I mean, maybe she's got an inappropriate personality. Maybe she cries herself to sleep every night. I don't know. But this is how she presents, like when she goes on stage and dances around and there's fireworks and everything. You know, it's tough. being a widow is tough. If you're all somber, that's really depressing, right? And like, it's hard to thread that needle. Mm-hmm. I don't think she was the natural heir to Turning Point, though.
No, I don't think so. I mean, if she was a natural, she would have already been part of Turning Point, in that sense. Like, she would have been a luminary in the thing before Kirk was murdered, not after.
I think she viewed it as a grift.
She might have. She might. See, I don't know, right? It's hard, like, the idea that, like, I don't know what I would have, I do know what I would have thought, but I don't know how to put myself in a position of having your husband's head blown off.
No.
If that makes sense.
It's not right. Good.
Like, that's very weird, that to be the widow of a husband that was effectively murdered in the public.
Yeah.
In what?
In many a gruesome way.
Yeah, in a very gruesome way. And so then it becomes, okay, he's the head of an organization. Okay, well, what do you do with that? Well, okay, I'm going to take over the organization. Okay, how do you present yourself to the world as you take over the organization in a way that gets across? I'm mourning my husband. By the same token, I need to run this thing. I don't know how to thread that needle. That's a hell of a needle to thread. A different personality may be able to pull it off, but she's not Charlotte Kirk, right? It's different. And add to it, from the standpoint of polling and approval, Trump is at a 37% approval rating with 2/3 of the country saying it's going in the wrong direction. Is Turning Point just an avatar for the Trump plan? Yeah, I think so. Like, I don't think there's a huge, like, meaning, is Turning Point affiliated with the Republican Party, or for that matter, with Trumpism? If the answer is yes, then as go Trump goes those organizations. Do you agree with that or disagree with that? Because I could be wrong on this. I could be talking out my ass. Because otherwise, we need to explain why they hit. It could be, A, Charlie Kirk is dead, in which case the organization suffered as a result of Charlie Kirk's death. Or it could be the Trump administration is going down in flames, and they failed miserably at everything that they were going to do. So this momentum is diminished.
Well, it could be that. I mean, look, the thing is, Turning Point played the sort of neat trick of being sort of like, enough, like, basically it was a conservative movement, not a Republican movement.
Right.
And post Charlie Kirk, it's become undeniably a Republican like vessel. And that's, you know, epitomized by the kind of boring and flaccid J.D. Vance going to, you know, and talking to this mostly empty crowd. Right. I mean, and they weren't interested in him. I mean, to the 20 somethings, and the teenagers who were a Turning Point people, J.D. Vance is an old guy. They're not interested in anything he has to say. And it's also like, what is he going to say that's new and interesting, right? It's the same shit. I mean, Charlie Kirk had this whole, like, it was about dialogue. And he drew strength from, you know, mixing it up with people who disagreed with him and, like, testing out his own ideas. I get that, because I'm sort of the same way. I find that super exciting and interesting. J.D. Vance isn't that guy. J.D. Vance is a part. He's exactly the opposite. He's an empty vessel who basically will do whatever you want if you pay him. And you know, and so he, you know, oh, you want me to be the anti-Trump, you know, auteur of like the hillbillies of West Virginia? I'll be that for you. Or you don't need me for that anymore. I'll go, you know, go Team MAGA all the way. So, yeah, I mean, I think Charlie Kirk had, for all of his faults, authenticity.
Yes.
And like the Erica Kirk and J.D. Vance and those people, they do not. And basically Turning Point, what is the point of it if it's just a the Hitler Jugend version of the GOP, right? There's no need for it.
You know what it puts me in mind of? They co-opted Turning Point in the same way that, let's say, elements of the left gets co-opted.
Like Bernie Sanders, like Our Revolution or anything like that.
It's like it was just eaten alive with, you know, this veneer.
Center for American Progress.
Yes.
That used to be a progressive organization.
Well, not anymore. They're just a Democratic organization now. Or were they always a stalking horse?
That's a good question. I mean, co-option is rampant, right? It's like people, individuals are always getting co-opted. Let's see here. A few more questions. Oh, this is for Robbie. How do your Christian beliefs influence your life and your political beliefs?
It's foundational to everything that it's foundational. Everything goes through that lens.
And by the way, it should be.
No, but I think so. I mean, yeah, it's pretty simple, right? So, you know, when he was asked by the Pharisees, what is the greatest commandment? And he famously said, love the Lord your God with all your heart and all your mind, and love your neighbor as yourself. I think that is a good way to kind of look at it, because that literally does, that hangs the law of the prophets and humanity as a whole. And people can have disagreements about it. People can say, well, Robbie, how can you say that, but be so hard on immigrants as you are? Like, I want closed borders. I want mass deportations, because I understand that resources are finite, and that before we take care of the whole world, maybe we should take care of our own people first. That's not a bad idea. That's not a bad position to have. I think any serious country should take care of its own people first, because they're your people.
You know, what's wild about this, Robbie, and to me, I'm sorry to interrupt.
No, you're
what's
fine.
Wild about this is I'm always confused about how that position ends up on the right, when to me, that's a lefty position.
Well, it should be.
Yeah.
But there is no left. That's the problem. There isn't a left. So you got right-wingers like me who have to pick up that mantle. Like, for example, you know, the whole anti-war movement. It is a phenomenon right now on the right. You have Tucker Carlson.
I know.
Who's leading the charge about American foreign policy and imperialism. And the lefty peaceniks are nowhere to be seen. They're cheerleading it.
Yeah.
And so for me, that's just now saying that's just phenomenal.
Well, it's a radical realignment on foreign policy that, you know, we've talked about and we will talk about more, and I've written about. But yeah, I mean, the 1960s liberals who are Democrats and radicals who are watching this show will remember and are probably screaming at me like, it was like that under LBJ, right? Like, hey, LBJ, how many kids did you kill today?
Right. Did you kill today? Right.
I don't know if you saw this, Ted, but I posted something on Facebook a couple of days ago, and I've thought about it, and I sincerely think that it's true. Republicans think I'm a liberal, but liberals hate me because they think I'm a fascist. Mm-hmm. And to me, that's an amazing place to be in, because my views are consistent. So I don't think that the whole left-right paradigm even works anymore. I think it's just completely broken down. I think now it has no
relationship whatsoever to the American electoral system. I mean, it still works. But it doesn't work. It has no relationship to the Democratic and Republican parties that's meaningful in any way. I'm going to keep you on here for this one. It might be one of our last ones in this hour. Manchild, thanks for the donation. Did y'all see the lawsuit from Kash Patel in The Atlantic? I did.
No.
And as a famous famous plaintiff in a defamation lawsuit against a media organization, I found it of great interest.
I didn't see it. What was the
beginning? So he's demanding 200. He's suing The Atlantic. The Atlantic wrote an article that was what was it? With the headline was, the FBI director is MIA, saying that Kash Patel is a drunkard who is visibly drunk all the time and is basically not in very often, and he's basically like a worthless drunken piece of shit scoundrel. So he's suing The Atlantic in U.S. federal court, and he's requesting $250 million in damages. It claimed that he drinks to the Atlantic said, quote, he drinks to the point of obvious intoxication at places like the members only clubs Ned's in Washington and the Poodle Room in Las Vegas. The Poodle Room. Ah, the Poodle Room, of course. I will say, having been in this position, that until Kash sued, I was inclined to believe The Atlantic. The fact that he's suing means that he's going to expose himself to discovery and depositions and all sorts of stuff that will prove if he's a lying sack of shit. This indicates to me that probably they got some of their reporting wrong.
I'm curious, though, even if they get it wrong, if they had sources for it, does that open them up to prosecution? Meaning, it's one thing if they just lie, right? It's another thing if they had sources in the room that pointed out, hey, he's drunk.
Well, that would be a defense. I mean, so basically the standard, right, he's a public figure. So right. Under 1964 Sullivan versus New York Times, the standard is as follows. A public figure must prove, intentional malice, right? In order, what that means is either they published what they were published and they knew it was a lie, or they had reckless negligence. In other words, they didn't know it was a lie, but they didn't really check it out carefully. Most of the time in American courts, they tend to side under the First Amendment with media organizations, even when they fuck up. Like Sarah Palin has been mm-hmm. fighting the New York Times now for years. She was absolutely wronged by the New York Times. But it's been very hard. It's been a very tough legal battle for her to get past all the protections that media organizations have. Actual malice is the term. That's the word I was looking for. So mostly it has to be a situation like with the Los Angeles Times. I had an unusual situation where I was able to demonstrate even before trial, they knew that what they published was a lie. In fact, they deliberately published it. They knew it was a lie, but they published it anyway. That's like very unusual. Mostly when you sue an organization, they never bothered to check anything. That's like Sarah Palin in the New York Times. They didn't check. Now, the thing is, reckless, like the negligence it should be actionable under the Supreme Court case law, but in practical terms, it almost never is. They tend to say like, what do? People make mistakes. So it would be a defense, a pretty strong defense to say like, listen, we had sources. We reported what the sources said. You take it up with them if they lied, but fuck you. I think, look, all defamation claims are an uphill battle in the United States. So when you sue, it's not really about winning. It's about winning in the court of public opinion.
Right. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think all of these people in Trump's administration leave something to be desired. Hegseth seems to be drunk. Kash Patel, I would take more issue with his girlfriend than his Israeli spy.
For sure. Yes.
Right? That's the other
honey pot. Right? Dude, she's a honeypot. Straight honey up. Pot.
Yeah. And that should not be used as a weapon. Just as a man, right? It's like that. It's too much of a weakness. Like, I don't, like, like, yeah, man, it's too much of a weakness. That's an unfair
weapon. I mean, no, you get some hot girl to go with this bug-eyed Indian dude. You're just like, I'm so into this. I want someone whose eyes look like they're about to roll out of their sockets because that gets the juices going. I want that.
That's the look you want to see huffing and puffing on top of you.
Yeah, 100%, man. Especially while you're drunk.
Yeah.
Payupa, last question. $6.99 Canadian. Thank you. Maybe you guys already talked about it, but have you seen the Florida student arrested for making a Netanyahu joke?
Yeah, I have not. I have not seen that.
All right, so Robbie, tell us what happened.
Okay, so she's University of Florida, if I remember right. I think it was University of Florida. Anyway, she was in a group chat and she was I can't remember what the class was, but basically she wanted to get the class postponed, just have it delayed. And so in the chat, she's just like, Benjamin Netanyahu, if you're listening, could you drop a bomb here so that way the class gets delayed? Well, I actually watched a clip. I have to find out. I'll send it to y'all. It's on X. Of the judge saying that wasn't funny, that you're making terroristic threats, and just basically she's being lamblasted.
Analogous structurally to when Trump at a rally said, like, oh, Russia, if you're listening, please, release Hillary Clinton's emails, right?
Right.
And then it was like Democrats were like, he's calling for espionage with Russia. It's like, shut up.
It's a joke. It is obviously a joke.
obviously.
Oh, right. And so the judge, this girl's just there in the orange jump, the orange suit. She looks Hispanic, really cute girl. And she stared up. She's terrified. I mean, her entire life is on the precipice of potentially being destroyed right now.
Are you fucking kidding me?
I am dead serious. I am so dead serious. It is disgusting what's going on here.
So, yeah, I'm looking four years ago. Yeah, she looks absolutely terrified. Oh, so it's Florida International University, which I've actually lectured at, FIU. And that is the college, you guys might remember.
Was it Florida International?
It was a left-wing, very woke school. That's why I lectured there. And then DeSantis took it over and had a purge and fired the lefty progressive professors and faculty and basically right-wingified it. This is DeSantis's doing.
Listen, other people in the chat aired the chat.
Yeah. Other people that aired the chat, they complained. Her fellow students did. And this girl could...
Yeah, right-wingers. Right-wing students, obviously.
Well, Ted, I'm right-winger. And as right-winger here on the show, I would have laughed my butt off and said, give me another joke. That's not right-winger.
It's funny. It's obviously a joke.
That's an authoritarian punk who is butthurt, who cannot understand the concept of a joke. If you're that emotional fragile, you have no business being in university and you have no right to vote.
She's been arrested. She hasn't gone to trial yet.
Yeah, she was arraigned, I think.
Yeah, yeah. So she has to raise $5,000 bond. That's not too bad because she only has to pay $500 to a bondsman.
Yeah, but the thing is, like, she has scholarships or something. Dude, she's done. She is done.
Yeah, she's done at FIU for sure.
I hope she sues the fuck out of that school.
She should sue for false arrest. I mean, obviously, look, okay, mark my words, guys. The prosecutor is going to drop this case.
Oh, yeah. That's all I'm saying. I hope she sues the hell out of the school. This is going nowhere.
I don't know. It's because
the fact that they put her through it.
She's going to be protected by the First Amendment.
If this is any other state except for Florida or Texas, I would agree with you. But both of those states are controlled by the Zionist lobby. I mean, the fact that DeSantis went to Jerusalem to sign an anti-Semitism bill should show you exactly what's going on in Florida.
Yeah, and I get that, but federal law supersedes state law. And the fact of the matter is,
under Trump, are you telling me under Trump that
this goes to court? Okay, we'll see. I'm very skeptical that this goes forward.
Listen,
if
we lived in a functional republic, I would agree with you. The problem is that we don't. That's the whole issue.
Judge said that it's not like, listen to what the judge said, right? Judge Mindy Glazier said, I can understand your position where you're saying this is a joke, but to an objective person, it's not a joke, and it would be enough for probable cause. I'm not saying it's enough for beyond a reasonable doubt. I don't know if the state is going to be able to prove it in trial, but for the purposes of this hearing, I believe there is enough for probable cause. That's a judge saying, like,
yeah. I mean, you can get probable cause on a ham sandwich.
Well, right? For sure. But I guess that maybe I'll have more faith in the system than I do. I think it's
not really.
I think it's completely burned down. No,
I think there's still some sanity. I will say that.
At least I hope on something like this. I mean, if she's convicted over this, yeah, you're right.
That's a major problem.
Now, if I was on Luigi's jury, he would never get convicted. And if I was on her jury, she would never get convicted.
Well, ditto. I mean, of course, look, objectively, Luigi Mangione is no doubt guilty of like second degree murder, right?
Is he? I don't think so. I think he was just there. I think he was just scooped up and he's just made a patsy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know. I need to see the trial.
Although I will say the bike escape story makes no sense.
Well, when would someone that smart make all those mistakes?
Well, also,
I mean, let's just be honest.
Well, here's the big one. So it's like the argument is that he just found a bike and stole it. He didn't take a city bike. He just found a bike. Okay, this is Manhattan. Okay, like people in this city, literally, they keep their plants chained to the ground because people steal their shrubs from in front of their building. Like anything that's not nailed down will be stolen. A bike, if you leave any shitty bike unattended for 5 seconds, it will be gone. So A, no one would ever leave a bike unattended like that. No one, no how, impossible. And you could not reasonably think, I will make my escape by jumping onto a random bike that's not tied up because I will find one. Like, no. Like, that just makes no sense.
Well, I mean, just at the risk of just going on a complete rabbit trail, no, we have to go. It's just like, you know, for example, the dude that they're accusing of shooting Charlie Kirk. That doesn't make any sense either.
Right.
As someone who shoots a lot of guns, I can 100% tell you, you are not going to field strip a Mauser in less than 2 minutes. Reassemble that puppy. Fire off your shot. Disassemble it again. Stick it down your pants. Go, then reassemble it, then drop it in bushes. The entire time, none of it makes any sense.
Yeah, actually, the dropping it thing. I mean, so you know, like famously in The Godfather, right? Like, leave the gun, take the cannolis. Why do people? Why in those movies? Why, like in The Sopranos, you always see people, they leave the gun. Why?
They leave the gun.
Why do you leave the gun? Why would you not take the gun with you and dispose of it in a body of water?
Well, yeah, I never understood that.
Well, on top of that, have either one of y'all ever saw a 30-06 bullet?
No.
Mm-mm.
We're on YouTube, so I can't show you. But they're like yay long.
Okay, I've seen those.
As I showed you and John.
They're like little missiles.
Oh, very much so. The bullet itself is about yay long. The actual case is typically longer. A human neck cannot fragment a 30-06. Doesn't matter if it's a lead head or a dum-dum. Mm-hmm. Doesn't matter. None of it makes any sense, and I don't trust a freaking thing our government says when it comes to.
Well, not to mention Charlie Kirk. This did not hit his skull, right? It like went right through his neck.
Yeah, there's no way. There's no way.
Yeah,
through the soft flesh.
Yeah, it just doesn't work. So I mean, I do not trust anything that our government says, and that's one of the reasons why I don't believe that this. Our entire justice system is a joke.
The thing about Luigi, though, is he's acting guilty, right? I mean, he's not like, I didn't do it, right?
Well, I didn't think he owned that he did it. Or did he?
Well, he's never owned that he did it. He's just sort of...
the man still hasn't had a trial. He's been in jail now for, 2 years?
Yeah. And they haven't had him talking either, right? Like, they've just kind of buried him.
I know. I mean, full disclosure, I wrote to him in prison and asked him for an interview, but never heard back.
We're supposed to have a right to a speedy trial. Where are those at? We have a legal system that's designed to protect the powerful, not a justice system that protects everybody.
I wish people like, you know, when he gives it, you know, when he does this, he'll end up being on 60 Minutes or whatever. But honestly, these people really should talk to independent journalists like us and get a better shot.
Agreed.
You know,
and a more honest interview.
Yeah, they'll be treated more respectfully, and it'll be better for them. Anyway, guys, let's all stick around after the show because we have to do a post-show meeting. But thanks everyone for tuning in for the Q&A episode of D Program with Ted Rollins, Jamal Thomas. We will be back tomorrow morning at 9 a.m. Eastern time, as we are Monday through Friday every single week. All right, bye guys.
Have a good one.
Stay. Bye.